Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1992, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a scientist. The fact that his father was a chemist and his mother a bacteriologist doesn't mean, he says, that a talent for science was in his genes. More likely, he was inspired by a good schoolteacher. It's a theory he can support better than most because genetics is his field. He's made a lifelong study of the evolution of the snail, the reproduction of the fruit fly, and the sex life of the slug. Eminent in his field now as head of genetics at University College London, he was invited a few months ago to give the Reith Lectures, during which he confounded all theories of racial purity, told us most of the world was descended from 10 Africans, and warned that, like mankind today, the dinosaur once believed himself to dominate the world. He is Dr. Steve Jones. Let's deal with your genes first, Steve. Surely you inherited an aptitude for science from your parents, even if they both proved themselves to be talented at the thing.
I suppose I did, but arguably I also inherited an aptitude for playing the piano, but I never learned to play the piano. So I think a great deal depends on one's environment as much as one's genes, and I genuinely think it's usually impossible to separate the two effects.
But you don't deny, do you, that we inherit physical characteristics like wide hips or big noses or red hair?
I think I'll give you red hair.
Well, we don't inherit the others.
A thing you don't often hear scientists say in public, although we say it in private all the time, is, I've got no idea. And the answer is, to those particular questions, I don't think anybody knows.
But what about things like intelligence? I mean, on the whole, two intelligent people tend to produce a fairly intelligent child. Or people, perhaps, who can write, their children tend to be able to write. People who can play the piano, their children tend to be musical.
Yes, that's again true. I mean, if you believe that these things evolved, it's hard to know, for example, how piano playing evolved. And of course, what's also true of two people who are intelligent is that they live in an environment. They have a household with lots of books in it. They send their children to good schools and they care about their children's upbringing. So I really would say it's extremely difficult. In fact, I'd go further and say it's probably impossible to disentangle the effects of nature from nurture in characteristics like that.
So it's your environment that creates you, not what you inherit from your parents.
It's both.
It's very unromantic, that.
Sad but true, most science is unromantic.
Does love of music run in your family?
I wouldn't say particularly. My brother is extremely fond of heavy metal music, which I'm not. So what that tells us about genetics, I don't know.
So what music have you chosen to take to your desert island?
Well, I thought if I was doomed to spend the rest of my life on the desert island, I'd better take something that reminded me of my main interest in life, which is about, I'm sad to say, genetics and evolution. So most of the things I'm taking have that kind of theme behind them, some of them perhaps more obviously than others. The one I'd like to start with actually has in its title the word which is anathema to all biologists, which is the creation. It's the creation by Haydn, but I like to think we're talking about the creation of the universe here, and I think we'd probably hear the Big Bang.
Part of the opening scene of Haydn's Creation, sung by Anthony Rolfe Johnson with the chorus and orchestra of the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Christopher Hogwood. During one of your Reith lectures, you encouraged us at one point to stick out our tongues and see if we could roll it into a tube, which I've discovered I can do. Can you do it?
I can't do it.
Okay. So what does that prove about us two?
Well, it tells us we're different in that particular attribute. Of course, the listeners can't tell whether we're doing it or not, so there's no way of proving this.
They have to believe it. But there's also the business of clasping your hands, you said, and which thumb you put over which one as you clasp your hands.
I mean, if people... What these are two perhaps rather silly examples, but surprising examples possibly, of the way in which any two randomly chosen people differ from each other in literally millions of inherited attributes. The tongue rolling is one. If you clasp your hands together, about half the population puts the left thumb on top of the right, and the other half, roughly, puts the right thumb on top of the left. If you try it the other way round, it feels very uncomfortable.
Does that mean that the people who do it the same way have the same gene?
Well, like many of these continuous characters, as we call them, the genetics isn't absolutely straightforward, but it certainly has some inherited component. It certainly runs in families. It reflects some hidden genetic diversity.
But we all have, each of us, we are unique. We all have a unique genetic plan, don't we?
With the exception of the famous identical twins, who we have to keep apologising about, I oughtn't to, actually, as my mother's one of an identical pair of identical twins. Not only do we all, the people living in the world today, have unique genetic attributes, unlike anybody else, but we're, each one of us, uniquely different from anybody who ever has lived or ever will live, which is quite an astonishing statistic.
So every time new life is created, it's like a pack of cards that's been reshuffled and has come out in a different pattern.
It's like a pack of cards which has got 3,000 million cards in it, which is a big pack of cards.
But all the cards have been used before somewhere along the line. It's just the pattern is different each time.
Roughly speaking, yes. Of course, life is never pure and rarely simple. What happens to some extent is, unlike a pack of cards, pursue this rather tortured analogy, each generation, some of the numbers on some of the cards change by mutation. And it's these mutations, these genetic accidents, which are the raw material of evolution. Evolution picks them up and acts on them and leads to the change which we've seen from our fossil ancestors to ourselves.
But how do you know, and because you said this in your Reith lecture, how do you know that we are all born of a handful of people from Africa?
That seems to be the most likely pattern. There are various bits of evidence which suggest that's true. The strongest evidence that we all came from Africa, I think, has to be in fossils, because the fossils are the absolute proof that there were humans living there before there were anywhere else. So that's the strongest evidence. But, if geography is about maps, the fossil record is basically about gaps. There aren't many fossils. So we can build on the dead fossils with ourselves as the fossil genes, which have descended from our predecessors. We can make a family tree of who's related to whom, and when you draw those lines of descent, they all seem to point back to Africa. And also, more important perhaps, if you look at the amount of genetic variation that there is among the peoples of the world, the most variable by far are the Africans, which suggests that perhaps they were the ancestors and we're just a small sample of our African great-great-great-grandmothers and grandfathers.
So just to simplify that a bit, because I'm not entirely sure I'm with you, we are more similar to Africans. The rest of the world is more similar to Africans than Africans are to each other.
Within Africa, different African peoples are as different one from the other as, shall we say, the population of Alaska is from the population of South America, suggesting that within Africa, as we also know from fossils, people have been sitting there and evolving and accumulating genetic diversity for far longer than they have been in the rest of the world.
Record number two.
Well, record number two is kind of, oddly enough, a kind of African record, and maybe I'll explain why after it's played. It's a record I think all of us know and love, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds by the Beatles.
A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
The Beatles and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Now, why is that an African song?
Well, most people perhaps have heard of perhaps the most famous human fossil of all, who's Lucy. And Lucy is an australopithecine fossil from Ethiopia. And it's an almost complete skeleton of a female child, very important in the theory of human evolution. She's called Lucy because Don Johansson, who collected the fossil in the early 1970s, was playing just that record on his Sonny Walkman while he was digging.
Good a reason as any. Let's go back to our all being descended from Africa. How many genes are involved in the difference in skin colour between the darkest black and the whitest white?
Again, I can't be completely confident of the answer because the genetics, surprisingly enough, I've never managed to find a really good genetical study of that. But a good guess would be less than 10, not very many.
So any black person could have white ancestors and vice versa?
In principle, yes. I mean, that's, of course, less likely to be true within Africa. But certainly without Africa, outside Africa, there's good evidence that that's true. And if you look at black Americans, you find that on the average, about a third of their genes come from white ancestors, from matings probably early in the days of slavery. So that's the sort of thing which genetics can tell you, which perhaps history won't.
All of which makes a nonsense of racism of any form.
Well, I would certainly agree with you very strongly. I would, however, go one step further and say that the issue of racism, to me, and I've always believed this, before I became a geneticist even, has nothing to do with biology. I mean, that's a political and social issue. And to me, the question of how genetically similar or different we are from each other is irrelevant to the question of racism.
How much do you feel the weight of the disreputable past of your science of genetics, the Hitlerian past of it? Do you feel, does that worry you?
I think it does in some senses. What I find a bit refreshing is the blissful ignorance of all genetics undergraduates about the fact that genetics does have a past. I think it's finally lived through its past. It took a long time and it was a very murky past indeed. As is often the case in science, people are most confident about what they say when they know least. And genetics has been no exception to that. When we look back at what the early human geneticists said in the 1920s, when we were basically absolutely ignorant, we were in the pre-Galileo phase of human genetics, geneticists who were professional geneticists were making shocking statements about the undesirability of different races marrying, the necessity to sterilise criminals and the like, which we now regard as nonsensical and arrogant. And I think with knowledge has come humility, and I hope with more knowledge will come yet more.
But the founder of the laboratory where you work at University College was in fact part of that murky past, wasn't he, Sir Francis Galton?
Well, I'm ashamed to say that I walk past his statue every day and I avert my eyes several times a day from it. He was the founder of it.
Didn't he try to make a beauty map of England?
That was one of his many eccentric things. He founded human genetics. He wrote a book called Hereditary Genius, where he tried to establish whether families of genius, which he defined in a slightly odd way, whether individuals in those families tended to be more likely to be geniuses than individuals in other families. And the answer was, not surprisingly, yes. That's what he's most remembered for. He wrote some other very odd scientific papers. The beauty map is a strange one. He went around Britain with a little brass counting device, which we still got, which he clicked off the score of the beauty of females on a score from 1 to 5.
Totally subjective judgment there.
Oh, absolutely. The low point, by the way, was in Aberdeen, for those who might be listening up there. I'm sure everything has changed since the
1890s. Where was the high point? Do you know?
High point, I think, was in London. So, I mean, that's clearly true.
But it was his work, wasn't it, which became the basis for the Nazis' race hygiene programme in the 30s?
Yes, more directly, I think, than many people would like to accept. There is a fairly direct link. I've always been struck by the fact that the title of Hitler's biography, Mein Kampf, My Struggle, is a direct translation of the Darwinian phrase, Darwin, Galton's cousin, the struggle for existence. So there is a direct linear relationship between that idea that there are genes for higher or lower races and the terrible political disasters which happened in the 1930s. And I think we really should not be allowed to forget that.
Record number three.
Well, record number three, again, I thought it would be nice to get away from something which is quite so politically charged and get back to the fossils. And we'll have a piece of fossil music, which is by Saint-Saëns. It's from the Carnival of the Animals, The Fossils.
Thank you.
fossils from Saint-Saëns The Carnival of the Animals with Katia and Mariella Labeck and the Israel Philharmonic conducted by Zubin Mehta.
It's a nice piece of music, I think particularly nice, because there's a couple of fossil tunes in there. I certainly picked up Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and I know there's at least two more.
And the bones were rattling nicely. Let's go back to your origin, Steve Jones, the Jones family of Aberystwyth. Presumably there are quite a few of them.
I think there are large numbers of us. I mean, if you get the Aberystwyth phone book, it's a very, very boring book.
But if you weren't genetically predestined to become a scientist, who or what nurtured your interest environmentally in science?
Well, I think, as is the case with many people's professions, maybe scientists more than anybody. I can trace my particular interest in science, and in biology in particular, in fact, back to one good school teacher. I mean, it's the standard thing, the most important social class in any society, which is often forgotten without question are school teachers. My school teacher, who I've never seen hide nor hair nor since, was a Mr. Simpson, who, when I was 13 or 14, taught me biology in a really inspired way and made me think seriously at that age that I wanted to be a biologist, and I've stuck with it.
How do you teach biology in an inspiring way? I think a lot of biology teachers might like to know.
Well, I do it by waving my arms around and cracking lots of bad jokes, and I think he probably did the same thing.
But were you in any case quite academic? Were you a bookish chap?
Yes, I was always being severely criticised by my parents for not going out and playing football and breaking into cars and doing all the things you're supposed to do. I used to go to the library a lot.
I read that you consumed the works of Dickens before the age of 14. Can this be true?
It's a terrible admission, but I'm afraid it is.
It's somehow nevertheless warming to read that you failed to get into several universities before Edinburgh accepted you.
Yes, all the Welsh universities turned me down. Before the days of computerised admission to university, which there now is, thank heavens, the only reason I managed to scrape under the net was that the University of Edinburgh had a closing date 7 days later than anybody else, and I managed to get it in the post just in time. I think it's the most important letter I ever posted.
And you went there to read zoology? With genetics as a subsid, yes?
Exactly, yes.
And once again you found a teacher who inspired you?
Yes, I hope he's not listening to this programme. Yes, I got an interest in snails, which I still have, from a chap who's now professor at Nottingham, Brian Clark. And like many scientists, again, what you do is you're given an essay to write in your first or your second year, and you never finish it. And I'm still writing that essay 25 years later on the genetics of snails.
Next record.
Well, the next record is actually, I think it's the only snaily record I can think of. It's the theme from The Magic Roundabout, and I think you'll notice that the snail, most people will know, is called Brian Snail. Perhaps a coincidence, perhaps not.
The original theme tune from The Magic Roundabout. So you began to study snails, rather perhaps as Darwin studied giant tortoises, or is that too grand an analogy for you?
It's fairly grand. I guess they're both sluggish. They have that in common. The beauty of snails is you don't have to run very fast when you pick them up.
But it's all to do with counting the lines on the backs, isn't it?
Yes, the main reason for studying snails is that they carry their genes on their shells, as it were. You can actually tell a lot about what genes they carry from the patterns on their shells.
So what have you discovered through studying snails for so many years?
Unfortunately, you've only got a 40-minute programme. If you'd have given me a series of 12 one-hours. Well, what I've discovered, I'm sure, is of complete lack of interest to everybody in the world, apart from about 10 people. It has to do with the fact that the patterns of genetic change in snails have a lot to do with the way in which they behave when they're exposed to the sun. So that's why snails in different places look different.
And then came fruit flies next, and a research fellowship at the University of Chicago. Now, why did you change from snails to fruit flies?
Well, I felt I was becoming too much of an aerospecialist. And also, I mean, fruit flies have more of a buzz about them, so to speak. If you're going to work on genetics, in those days, you really had to work on fruit flies, Drosophila, because they were the classic organisms for doing genetics on. Strangely enough, since then, in the last 20 years, there's a new species which has become much more popular and much more useful, which is ourselves. And that's a complete reversal. because 20 years ago we knew almost nothing about human genetics, but that's altered. But 20 years ago everybody was working on fruit flies, so I felt I should join on the bandwagon, and on it I jumped.
But how can you study a fly? I mean, you can't mark it like a bird, you can't tag it, you can't follow it around because they all look the same. What do you do?
Well, you do terrible things to them in bottles, beta, a lot. I did lots of breeding experiments in the lab. But I did, in fact, spend several years trying to chase fruit flies around the deserts of California. I was interested in how far they migrated, how much the genes moved every generation. And I've also done quite a lot of work on the mating behavior of fruit flies, because a lot of genetics is just that. It's the scientific study of sex. Fruit flies mate by buzzing at each other, and they turn out to be mutations, genetic changes, which alter the shape and the sounds of those buzzes, and that's very, very important in their evolution.
But how do you discover all of that when you're chasing these flies?
The answer is with difficulty. We mark them by putting fluorescent dusts on them and chasing them around the desert with an ultraviolet lamp, which is a very peculiar thing to do, and I was shot at a number of times, but fortunately people missed every time.
Shot at by what, people who thought you were plainly mad, I think?
Mad or bad, certainly dangerous to know.
Record number 5.
Well, this, too, is an evolutionary one. It's about Orpheus going down to the underworld to find himself a mate, and appropriately enough, at some time during his rather unlikely adventures, he and his mate find themselves turned into two flies who make an interesting courtship song.
Richard Angus and Lillian Watson singing part of the Fly Duet from Act 3 of Offenbach's Orpheus in the Underworld, with the English National Opera Orchestra conducted by Mark Elder. We've talked, Steve Jones, about your work and our understanding of genetics and how it affects moral and really rather sinister issues such as racism and the creation of a master race. But there's another moral issue, isn't there? And that's foreknowledge, the ability to predict the future of a fetus, the ability to predict death.
Yes, I think that's really the one issue of genetics which people until recently haven't begun to come to terms with, is just that. It does tell you a great deal about perhaps what your own fate might be. It's quite clear now that there are certain unfortunate individuals who inherit particular genes, which if they learn about it, they know they're likely to suffer from quite severe and distressing diseases, perhaps early in life, perhaps later in life. That's becoming more and more true. For example, many, many different cancers, heart disease, many of the illnesses which plague modern life, turn out to have a strong genetic component.
So scientifically it's possible to say this, by testing, this fetus will develop cancer of the colon age 25?
That's putting it perhaps a bit too strongly. This child is more likely than average to develop cancer of the colon, would be a better way of putting it, because we can never be absolutely sure. That's rather a good example, in fact, because a colleague of mine in my own laboratory just a few months ago carried out the first test of that kind on a fetus, and it showed that there was some, in that particular individual, actually, fortunately, the child wasn't carrying the appropriate gene.
But tell me what else. Give me a few more examples of what we might ultimately be able to predict about a fetus.
I think, I'm rather plucking figures out of the air, but my guess is that up to half of all people born, one could have a fairly good chance of what their most likely cause of death is, and that's rather a guess, the figure, from studying their genes. sooner or later.
Good heavens, that they would have a weak heart.
That they might. But there's a positive way of looking at it. I mean, I think the most important thing is to be positive about it. What happens with these various genes is that they make you susceptible to particular environmental agents. For example, there's a classic one, which if you have this particular gene, which is rather rare, I'm glad to say, and you smoke, which is a terminally stupid thing to do anyway, irrespective of genetics, then you are not just likely, but almost certain to die of emphysema, which is a very painful breathing disease, when you're young. Now, it would be feasible perhaps to tell people you are at particularly high risk if you smoke, and then hence to advise them not to smoke.
But I wonder how acceptable it is. I mean, we've already accepted, haven't we, that we can foretell the sex of a fetus with an amniocentesis test. We also now, I think, accept that the prediction that child could suffer from Down syndrome or cerebral palsy, and again, prospective parents can decide whether they want to terminate that pregnancy. Now, I wonder what happens when you are faced with the choice of, if you give birth to this child, it is likely to die of heart disease aged 30.
Well, that's a difficult choice, and in some ways, I think a geneticist, I mean, particularly a non-medical geneticist like myself, as I must always say, I'm not a physician and I don't know in detail. Geneticists are the last people to answer those questions because they're questions which should be answered by society. And the question of whether, I think it's true to say, that the question of whether parents should be allowed, should decide whether to continue with a pregnancy or not, should absolutely be made by the parents themselves.
Of course, but it becomes a form of genetic engineering, doesn't it? If through genetics we are being told things and therefore asked to make a practical decision. I mean, in a sense, you must have a view as to whether you think the knowledge ought to be used.
I think it's a good general view in science and in life, which is that ignorance is bad, and that generally has worked. There's a bumper sticker, an excellent one. If you think education is expensive, try ignorance. And I think the best that scientists can do, biologists can do, is to inform people of what choices are available to them. And the experience has been that when people are informed of these choices, they do make what seem to be very intelligent decisions, in genetic disease, for example.
Next piece of music.
Well, again, I thought perhaps to lighten the mood a bit, we'd get back to the evolutionary evolutionary theme, in fact, to human evolution, a very important document in the history of the theory of human evolution, which is Tommy Steele with the cavemen.
The old time cave dweller lived in a cave. Is what he did when he wanted to rave. He took a stick and he drew on the wall. Man out of hell had himself a ball. Rock with the caveman. Roll with the caveman. Shake with the caveman. Tight style of mind, I'll hold your baby very tight. His way with women was rather neat.
Tommy Steele singing Rock with the Caveman.
You know, there's a new theory about the origin of human language when in our history language first appeared. And the new theory is that song came before speech. Listen to that record makes me doubt the theory very much.
What are you going to do on the desert island, Steve Jones? I suppose in many ways it could be business as usual for
you. Oh, yes, I can't think of a better place to be. Because for an evolutionist, an island is a natural laboratory where evolution can take place more rapidly than anywhere else. And our great hero Charles Darwin, of course, as everybody knows, went to the Galapagos. People tend to think he thought of the idea of natural selection there. He actually didn't. But he was certainly very much impressed by the biology of islands, and that led him to the theme that different species of animals could change one into the other. So I wouldn't have a dull moment on my desert island.
What you couldn't do, of course, on your own on a desert island is breed, which, again, according to your lectures, is the healthiest thing genetically the human race can do.
Well, you certainly, if you look at people on islands, and of course there are people who live on different kinds of islands, there are islands surrounded by water, your desert islands, but there are sort of intellectual desert islands in the sense that there are strict religious isolates, for example, where we have people who refuse to mate or marry with others outside the group. What happens is they become inbred. And what that leads to is a certain danger of particular genes, which are usually rare, becoming more and more common by chance. And some of the island peoples of the world are living natural genetic laboratories for human genetics. The island of Tristan da Cunha, for example, is one. The religious isolate, the island, the intellectual island in North America, who are the Amish, are another one. These have a number of otherwise very rare genes, which happen to have risen in frequency, and are hence very, very important in human genetics.
But are they genes for the good or genes for the bad?
Well, in these particular cases, they become noticed because they cause inborn errors of different kinds. So in these cases, they're genes for the bad.
But to go back to what we ought to be doing as far as geneticists are concerned, we should be, what, ideally travelling from continent to continent, breeding out with people from as far away from where we come from as possible.
Well, ought, I don't think, is a word. You know, ought is a sort of eugenic term to it we don't like. What is happening is clearly that people are no longer marrying the girl or the boy next door. It is certainly happening, generally speaking, that there is much less inbreeding, much less marriage of relatives in human populations. The reason for that is obvious. It's increased transport. I think the most important ever eugenic device was probably the bicycle. People began to move from village to village. And it may be that because of that, because we're having less inbreeding, we're getting less like island populations, we're getting more like large continental outbred populations, so we may be going through a period of genetic health, which will greatly outweigh anything which geneticists can do. This simple behavioural change will lead to a change in human evolution.
And what about you as an individual? Are you playing your part in this?
I'm afraid to say my Darwinian fitness, my genetic value is exactly zero, as I have no children.
But you have a partner from another continent, eh?
From the United States, indeed, yes.
Record number 7.
Yes, I thought I'd like to have a bit more of a genetical record, in fact, a eugenic record. Eugenic comes from the word Eugene, well-born, and my next record is from Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin.
Part of the Polonaise from Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin, played by the orchestra of the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. I think one of the most daunting points that you made in your lectures was what a relatively small way down the road geneticists were. I think you drew the analogy of if you're going from Land's End to John O'Groats, you're sort of 2 miles from Land's End so far.
Yes, I mean, there is a programme which is hoped to be finished by the year 2015 to read off the genetic message in a single human being, and that's a message which is 3,000 million letters long. And it's rather hard to get a vision of how much that represents. The way I tried to illustrate it is by talking about the sequencing as being equivalent to walking from Land's End to John O'Groats via London. And if you add up what's been done so far, we haven't yet got to Penzance, so there's a long way to go yet.
But you've been quoted as saying, and I find this very odd, anyone can be a scientist. What do you mean by that? That sounds ridiculously modest with respect.
No, I actually think it's a real truth, which I think most scientists would acknowledge. It is absolutely not the case, it seems to me, that any one of us or anybody can be a good artist or an artist of any kind. To take a trivial example, nobody would have written Eugene Onegin if Tchaikovsky hadn't written it. Somebody would have discovered the structure of DNA if Francis Crick had not done so. I once made a radio program a long time ago about a field course we run in Spain where we do things, we study the biology of various animals and look at genetics in the field, which is fun to do. And a friend of mine who's got a 5-year-old child said, well, that's all very well, but that's exactly the kind of thing my kid does in playgroup. And I said, well, exactly, your child is doing science in playgroup. He's finding out things, discovering things. And all that science really is a big playgroup that's not really as much fun. And I have yet to find a 5-year-old child who can't do something in a playgroup. And I think the same is true with an adult who can't do something to helping the progress of science.
That sounds very convincing, but at the same time, aren't you perhaps guilty of taking for granted something that you've been, whether it's genetically or God-given, and that is that you have an astounding clarity of thought. Well, delete the astounding. You have clarity of thought, and that is not something that everybody has.
I find that statement very confusing.
All right, let you off record number 8.
Number 8 is the last record, and having had the 60s in with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, I'd like to play something by what was without doubt the best band of the 60s, which just disappeared. It was called the Incredible String Band, and fortunately enough, they came out with a great track called the Evolution Rag.
Eat air croquettes, my children dear, if you want to save yourself time and tears. History picnickers, follow me. Evolution up the slopes of the sea, up the slopes of the sea. Up the slopes of the sea.
Evolution Rag from the Incredible String Band. So, Steve Jones, which one of those 8 records is the one you'd take if you could only take one?
Well, I'm afraid it's predictable. It's got to be Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
The fossil record.
Mm-hmm.
And your book, as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
There's a series of books. I know I'm not allowed a series, but there's a series of books by Anthony Powell called A Dance to the Music of Time, which actually is a really lovely way of describing evolution. If I have to take just one of them, my favourite one is called The Valley of Bones.
And your luxury?
Well, at University College London, where I work, we honour our founder, Jeremy Bentham, by keeping his stuffed body on the premises. I'd like to honour the present Minister of Education, Kenneth Clark, by taking his stuffed body to my desert island.
Dr. Steve Jones, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. Thank you.